Okay, so welcome again. And this is. Oh, it's not working. I've got to hold up here because my PowerPoint's frozen. There we go. Things might go a bit slow today because my laptop's just running a little bit slow, but we've got there. So that's our topic for tonight. I mentioned it last time, introduced it briefly. We're going to look at how the New Testament writers used the Old Testament scriptures. If we were to do everything on that, we'd be here for months and months. It's such a huge topic, because just about every writer in the New Testament refers to the Old Testament, and in some cases, several times, and in like Paul's case, several times every page. But it's a very important topic because it will illustrate what I've been talking about the continuity and the contrast that goes on between the various parts of the Bible. And we are concentrating on what's happening in Matthew's Gospel. And there's a reason for that, as you'll see as we go through it. And last time I showed you four particular places, and there they are again. So let's start with those. And there's four, but there's others, and I left it with you to see if you could find any others. So I'll be asking you in a moment. But let's, the first four are all pretty close together. So if you open to Matthew chapter 1 and 2, and I'll just read them out. So it's Matthew chapter 1, verses 22 to 23. Matthew 1, 22 to 23. Matthew chapter 2, 15b, in other words, partway through verse 15 of chapter 2. And a little bit later in chapter 2, verses 17 and 18. And then right at the end of chapter 2, partway through verse 23. And all of those four have got one thing in common. They all begin with a phrase which is usually pretty much the same. All this took place to fulfill what the Lord had said through the prophet. Or so was fulfilled what was said through the prophet. And then comes the quotation. And that's why these particular quotations are sometimes called the formula quotations, because they have this formula to introduce them. And it's a formula which is unique to Matthew. No other gospel writer, no other New Testament writer introduces the New Testament quotes in the same way. So that's how you know how to find the others. Anyone found any of the remaining six before I put them all up? Anyone want to show off?
Yeah, I've got them all.
You got them all. Just give us
Good.
Give us one of the chapters that you found it in.
Well, number five would be 4:14.
Okay, chapter 4, verse 14, and then on into 16, 14, 15, and 16. But chapter 4, verse 14 is the beginning of it. Anyone else want to chime in with another one?
5:17.
Chapter 5.
Yeah. Verse 17.
No, no.
Actually,
What we're looking for,
yeah.
Matthew himself saying, and this took place so that what the prophet said was fulfilled. This is just Jesus speaking.
8:17 then.
Yep.
8:17, yes. 8:17 is the next one. We move on a bit after that. Anyone got the next one?
I have, but I'll let somebody else speak.
Okay. You've got to turn a few chapters.
Hint, hint, 12.
Yeah, chapter 12, verse.
18 to 21.
Yeah, and the formula is in verse 17. Okay. It'd be really great if you've got all your fingers keeping these in places so that we can We're going to go through them all eventually. That's really the aim of today, is to look at them all in some detail. After chapter 12, there's another one in chapter 13.
Verse 14.
Yep.
Oh. No, that's not... I'll explain that in a minute, but that's not going to count.
Okay, then verse 35.
Verse 35, okay.
Which chapter?
Chapter 13, verse 35. They'll all come up on your screen in a moment, and I will explain why you think that there's more. So don't be too put off by that.
Ooh.
We have to turn over quite a few pages to find the next one.
I've got one in 21, but I don't know if there's one before that now.
No, that is the next one.
Verse 4 and 5.
And then quite a few more chapters further on. Have a look in chapter 27.
Verse 9
and 10 onwards. Right, here they are. Whoops, gone too far. So I'll read these out now. These are the remaining six. Chapter 4, verses 14 to 16. Chapter 8, verse 17. Chapter 12, verses 17 to 21. Chapter 13, 35. 21, 4 to 5. 27, 9 and 10. Now, those are the 10 which all begin in a very, very similar way, stereotypical way, if you like, with using this formula. And the reason that you might have thought there's a few more, because there are four other places, and I think someone mentioned chapter 13,
yep,
verses 14 and 15. Did someone mention chapter 5? You might have thought that chapter 26, verse 56 was one of them, and so on. But what makes those other four different is that they don't actually have that formula to start with. In some cases, it's Jesus himself that is speaking. And we're looking at ones where it's Matthew that is introducing it, because this is Matthew acting as a commentator, as a writer, putting in a little aside, if you like, or an extra thing. This is showing his take on things, his theology. Okay, so they will all be unique to what Matthew is trying to say, to tell his story. Okay, so yes, there are one or two others that are close, and some people, you know, you could include them because it refers back to the Old Testament, but these are the ones that are very specifically Matthew himself trying to tell us something, and we'll see what that something is by the end, as he goes through the whole Gospel. Now, one thing that you might have noticed, and if you didn't, you can check one now. When he says he's quoting something from the Old Testament, does he actually quote it correctly? Does it look the same as you've got in your Old Testament? So, for instance, you could pick one of them, any one, and see if it reads the same as the quotation itself. And for that, you either need perhaps the footnote in your gospel to tell you where to turn to, because, of course, Matthew couldn't say it was fulfilled from Isaiah chapter something, verse something, because, of course, there were no chapters and no verses. And everybody knew the scriptures without these numbers in them. So they didn't have a problem then. And what I'm expecting you'll find as you choose one, and as we go through them individually, you can keep doing this. So this is just to introduce the idea that you'll find that he doesn't really quote your Old Testament. It's not the same. And there's several reasons. One reason is that he's using a version called the Septuagint, if you've heard of that. This is the Greek version of the Hebrew scriptures, which was translated in the 3rd century BC. And therefore, by Jesus' day and the 1st century, this was a very common version of the Hebrew scriptures. And it would make a lot of sense for Matthew to use this because he's writing his gospel in Greek, or at least eventually it's in Greek. Some people think there might be some Hebrew version in the background of it. But he's very happy to quote the Septuagint version. Because after all, in your Gospel of Matthew, it is in Greek anyway. So it's a different language from when you look it up in Isaiah or whatever. And you find exactly the same with Paul and all the others. But it's more complicated than that. And those that study this sort of thing in great detail love to find out exactly how he's done it. In some cases, he uses the Hebrew text. Some cases, he uses the Greek text. Sometimes he mixes it in the same quotation. And sometimes it's neither of them, and he seems to be doing his own. So he's having either a lot of fun with all this, or he's doing something. And if we're not careful, we think, this is a bit dodgy. How dare you do this? And in fact, the way he's going to use these scriptures, we have to overcome this idea that, well, we're told you can't do that sort of thing to the Bible. But what he's doing is something very, very Jewish. And it will be understood as such and accepted as such. He's not doing what modern Bible scholars are told not to do, or preachers are told not to do. And of course, we trust him because God has allowed him to do this anyway. And all of these are to do with the idea of fulfillment. That's why you've got to find this word in however the formula is set up. It will always have this word fulfillment in it. And by the end, we're going to see what he means by that, because again, it might not necessarily be what we particularly think. What he is doing is something called midrash. Has anyone heard of the word midrash?
Yeah.
Okay. By the end, again, if we've got a bit of time, I'll explain a bit more what that's about. And maybe on another occasion, we'll do some more ourselves. I don't mean we'll do it ourselves. We will find them in the Bible and do some separate studies. Midrash is a way of looking at the scriptures and bringing extra meaning out of them. And the thing to bear in mind as we go through all these, all the time think, what is Matthew trying to tell us about Israel and Jesus? What connection is he making? And therefore, how is he thinking? Because he'd be thinking in terms of the covenants, which is what I've talked about before. How do the covenants help link together the whole story? We've moved on now into a new covenant, or about to. Certainly by the time Matthew was writing it, it was new covenant time. And he is wanting us to see Jesus and Israel closely linked together.
Hello, Harriet's just joined us.
Okay, hello.
Hi. Just come back from Israel.
Welcome. Lovely to see you.
So we're going to look at these 10 now, okay, and I'll say a few things in each case, and you'll have a chance to ask any questions if you still find it a bit puzzling. So the first one is in Matthew 1, 22 to 23, and it is Isaiah 7, 14. Now, again, if you can juggle your way around this, and you can open the Old Testament, Isaiah 7, 14, as well as having Matthew's version there. Can you spot a particular difference, an issue, if you like? He seems to be misquoting it. I think it won't matter which particular translation you've got. So what Matthew has said is that the virgin will be with child and will give birth to a son, and they will call him Emmanuel. Mm-hmm. It doesn't say that in Isaiah. It doesn't say they will call. It says something else.
And she will call.
It says she will call. It might even say, or you will call, but certainly it doesn't say they will call. He's definitely changed it. Okay? Now, there's a simple reason behind this, and that in Isaiah, it would be she, in other words, the woman in the text, who would call this person Emmanuel. But what we know, of course, is that Jesus was never called Emmanuel, and Mary wasn't going to call him Emmanuel. Mary's just been told, you'll give him the name Jesus. So it seems a bit contradictory if Matthew is now saying the virgin will conceive, give birth to a son, and she'll call him Emmanuel. No, she won't. She's been told to call him Jesus. And nobody ever, ever called Jesus Emmanuel while he was on earth. Okay? But Matthew is going to make a point out of this, so I'll explain in a moment. Another issue with this verse is that Matthew is not using this to try and prove anything about the virgin birth at all. It's not even the main point. And when you look at what...
joined us now as well.
Say again, sorry?
Judith has just joined us.
Hi there. Right, thank you. Matthew is using this text from Isaiah, and I don't know again quite what you've got in your particular version, but it might say in Isaiah that it's a young woman.
Yeah.
Not the content, just the volume.
No, I was just turning the volume down.
You want to end?
Can you hear me all right? We're still going?
Thank you.
All right. Now, what you have to understand is that in Isaiah's day, he was giving a particular prophetic sign for his own set of circumstances. Isaiah was not giving a prediction about Jesus. That's not how it works. Isaiah was speaking into his own time, and he was giving a prophecy to King Ahaz in the 8th century BC, and it's there that it had its primary meaning and its fulfillment. It's in a time of international tension, impending war, and Isaiah predicts the birth of a child such that by the time that child reaches early childhood, Judah's enemies will be destroyed, and this will be a sign that God is with his people. Now, Isaiah doesn't in himself name the child, and nobody really knows who it is. But Isaiah is saying that in his own day, a young woman will give birth to a child, and that will be a sign that God is going to do something. Now, when Isaiah uses the word for young woman, in those days, any young woman of marriageable age and who wasn't yet married would inevitably be a virgin anyway, because in their society that's what happened. Or perhaps better say that wrong things didn't happen. And he doesn't even mean at this stage in Isaiah that this young woman was already married. It might be that there is a young woman about to get married, and when she does and produces this child, this is a sign that God is giving to Israel, that he is with them in the troubles that's coming up. So we have to understand the initial text, because this is how Matthew understood it. Matthew knew exactly what Isaiah was saying. And what Matthew is not doing, and I've been saying this all the way through, is he's not looking for a collection of proof texts in order to help him make his point. The virgin birth is not the main point. Matthew has already discussed that. He's already made it very clear about why Jesus was born of a virgin. So Matthew can actually use the word virgin because Mary was, but the whole point of it is Emmanuel. So why is he wanting to make that particular point when Jesus was never called Emmanuel? Simply because it means God with us. And right at the beginning, he wants to alert us, if you like, to the fact that the more we learn about Jesus, the more we go through this story about Jesus, the more we will come to realize that he is God with us. And by the very end of the gospel, I'm sure you remember how it ends, but the Great Commission, and when Jesus tells the disciples to go into all the world and make more disciples and so on, he leaves them with a promise, I will be with you until the end of the age. So almost right at the very end, Jesus is saying, I am your Emmanuel. And that explains the they. Who's the they? Well, it does. It's anybody who eventually realizes that this son that has been born is indeed our Emmanuel. So we can use that title about it. Okay? I hope I've explained the pros and cons of that. Any questions?
Yeah. Just to clarify then, you're saying that Isaiah is not prophesying about Jesus.
Absolutely right. He definitely isn't.
Okay.
And Matthew isn't looking back and thinking, somewhere there must be a proof text which prophesies about Jesus. One day we will look at prophecy in more detail, and we have to understand there's what's called double fulfillments, or even sometimes what's called partial fulfillments. And what that means is that just because a prophecy has come true at one period of time, it doesn't mean that it can't come true again later. Or you can't look back at it and see that there is a deeper fulfillment. There is a bigger fulfillment of it. And what I'm also not saying is that God himself didn't... let me try and put it the right way around. God may well have, when he gave Isaiah that prophecy for his own time, he will have had in mind that one day this was going to have a bigger fulfillment. But you have to explain that to Isaiah. Okay? So in that sense, and nobody at the time reading Isaiah would have understood that as a messianic prophecy. It was a prophecy about the situation in their own day, in which, as I say, I put this up now, I've talked about it. It's a sign in Isaiah's day rather than messianic prophecy. And he uses the word, if Isaiah had wanted to say virgin, he would have had a different word he could have used, betula. He said he uses Alma to mean a young woman, someone probably about to get married, but by implication a virgin. So Matthew has no problem in picking this up and applying it to Mary, even though, of course, Isaiah was not thinking of Mary at all. So Matthew can use the Greek word for virgin, which is parthenos. He's more interested, though, in the idea of Emmanuel. He wants us to understand that we're going on a journey with this person who will increasingly be revealed as God with us. Any other questions on that one? Because we need to move on, I think.
That's just burst all of the teaching I've heard for many years right out the window.
Okay. Well, hopefully in a good way, but...
Is nobody else surprised about that?
I think he's not actually saying something. Correct me, Paul, if I'm wrong. I think Paul has left the space for God to be using that prophecy about Jesus' virgin birth.
Yes, that's right. I have said that. Isaiah wasn't predicting something. Well, he was predicting something, and it would have come true in his own time. Okay?
This concept of prophecy having layers of fulfillment.
Exactly.
So Isaiah's plan of the prophecy that, fulfilled in Isaiah's day, and then got in, because God designed scripture in this extraordinary way that it is true for all people for all time, it had a further fulfillment, and other prophecies may have.
Yes. But the point of the fulfillment is in the Emmanuel bit, not in the virgin birth. It's almost like the virgin birth is the link between them, but Matthew's point of using it is the Emmanuel point. Okay? He's not trying to convince us about the virgin birth. He's already covered that in the opening chapter and a bit. That's already well underway, if you like. And in those days, those that knew that about Jesus didn't need a proof text to do that. So yes, there are these layers, and this comes back to the idea of fulfillment, which I'm going to mention hopefully at the very end to sort of wrap the whole thing up. Let's move on to the next one. And Matthew 2:15b is Hosea 11:1. Now this one's very short. You might think it's very similar. Very simple, very easy to come to terms with. Are there any noticeable differences between what Matthew quotes and what Hosea actually says? Is it word for word, or is it close enough, or do you think there's a problem?
Hosea talks about Israel being the young man.
Yeah, okay. Remember what I said before, time and again, Matthew is trying to link Israel to Jesus. Mm-hmm. And if you think about the verse in Hosea, there is absolutely nothing prophetic or predictive about it. It's just a fact, isn't it? This is what God did in Israel's time. What Matthew has seen is that the fact that Jesus and his parents went down into Egypt seems an extraordinary sort of parallel. So he thinks it's worth mentioning. And if anything, the emphasis that he's making is the fact that God looked after his people in Israel, in Egypt. He looked after Israel in Egypt. He also looked after Jesus in Egypt as a young boy, young child. And if Israel was regarded as a son in Hosea, even more so now Jesus in this context. The reason I put that other phrase up there, shouldn't it be after chapter 2, verse 21? Because with all the other formula quotations, they all come after the event. You know, he talks about it, and then he says, and this was written to be fulfilled. This seems to be, I won't call it misplaced, but it's been placed earlier. In other words, so was fulfilled that the Lord has said, out of Egypt I've called my son. But it's not until you get to verse 21 that they actually leave Egypt. So he's actually put it at the time they go into Egypt, almost to sort of tell us, don't worry, he's gone into Egypt, but he's going to come out again. And in the meantime, he's going to be preserved, because this is what God did to his former son, Israel. That's about it on that one. It's nice when some of them are quite straightforward like that. Any questions, or should we look at the next one?
I've got a comment in my Bible.
Oh, it's Wendy.
Hi.
On which one?
This out of Egypt.
Yeah.
2:15. It's a long paragraph, but I'll read you half of it. Though the passage quoted here from Hosea was originally about Israel, Matthew applied it to Jesus. This is an example of the interpretive flexibility that was common among Jewish groups of the first century.
Yeah. That's Bible, what...
Sentence. The Bible was mined for hints and clues about the present working of God.
Yeah. That's why I called Midrash. You sort of summed up what Midrash is in that. Which Bible are you using there?
Well, please don't laugh. I bought this about a year ago, thinking I bought the NIV, which I have. But it's a first century study Bible, explores scripture in its Jewish and early Christian context, discovered tonight.
Yeah, it's good because it adds that sort of comment. It is the New International Version text.
Got lots of little boxes in.
I've got it.
Back to the Dead Sea Scrolls and all
that. Yeah, Well, that's a good comment, and thanks for sharing that, because that is exactly what Matthew is doing. Under the inspiration of the Holy Spirit, he is, well, in fact, he knows all these scriptures. He's learnt them all. He was a young Jewish boy. He can quote them all anyway. And these things are resonating in his mind. Every time he thinks about Jesus, he's thinking about something else that happened to Israel. The next one, then, is referring to somewhere in Jeremiah. So, Jeremiah 31:15. Now, the first thing I could say about this is that when you look at Matthew's introductory formula, he just says, then what was said through the prophet Jeremiah was fulfilled. He doesn't say, in quite the same strong sort of way, that all this took place in order to fulfill it. He's lessening the sense of purpose here, and the reason for that is that this is about something pretty bad, because this is actually about Herod killing all the little boys, and he doesn't want it to be sort of more closely attributed, as though somehow God purposed this and intended it. He's still making a link, but he's doing it in a more neutral sort of way. So God might have been thinking about Jesus when Isaiah talked about the situation, and God will have certainly known that Jesus was going down into Egypt and so on. So Matthew is making a comparison here, but he doesn't want to attribute as a sort of direct fulfillment of prophecy what Herod actually did. Now, one of the problems that we have with these quotations is that we do not know these scriptures quite as well as Matthew did, and that the Jews did in their day. So don't blame you at all if you're sort of scrambling around to try and work out what's going on in Jeremiah 31 verse 15. And in fact, Jeremiah himself is actually looking back to an earlier event, Rachel weeping for her children and so on. So we've got to not only know Jeremiah, we've got to know those bits from earlier, for instance, in Genesis, what happened. Is there anything about Rachel that you can think of that might help?
Was she not the one who had trouble in her pregnancy and said, Lord, what's going on here? I'm so uncomfy. And he said, there's two nations in your womb. Then is it that she had two children who were particularly awkward for her to bring up? And one went off at one tangent and the other went off in another way for 20 years plus. Is that what we're referring to?
Not quite. Because that doesn't fit in with the place and the weeping and so on. How did she die?
Isn't she the one whose death is not even mentioned?
We'll find it in Genesis 35.
Then he buried her.
Where?
On the road he was travelling because he hadn't yet arrived.
And who's the he that's...
Jacob.
Right. And how does she die?
In childbirth. Shortly after the birth of Benjamin.
Benjamin, right. Okay. So Jeremiah is using the death of Rachel in giving birth to Benjamin, which is in Genesis 35, verse 16 and to 20. Because that stayed with the Jewish people as a very sad moment. There was a grief associated with her death. And in fact, Rachel was probably regarded as the symbol of motherhood within the Jewish people. Now, there's one or two extra complications, because Yes, she died in childbirth. Well, it says in Genesis, near Bethlehem. Is it on the way to Bethlehem?
Yeah, she hadn't arrived. Mm-hmm.
Yes, but it's on the way to Bethlehem. A pregnant woman died.
Okay.
And gave birth on the way to Bethlehem. Now, in the end, she was her tomb is regarded as being somewhere else. Her body was eventually relocated, shall we say. And it was relocated to a place, you can look it up in 1 Samuel. So there's an awful lot going on here. And that was in the vicinity of Ramah. So that's why the reference is to this place, Ramah, because eventually Rachel was buried there, even though she died somewhere else. Now, the reference to Rachel weeping for her children is a symbolic one, because Rachel herself went through this sad thing and people wept for her. The other interesting thing, I mean, so there's a comparison here with the mothers weeping over their children because of what Herod has done. And all that Matthew is trying to produce on it, but he's trying to draw this picture out that similar sadness had happened before. Rachel, and everybody knew about that. And in fact, she was buried near Ramah, which was actually on the route taken by the captives going into exile. Again, all that's in Jeremiah. So Jeremiah is referring to the weeping that went on as the exiles were taken off. As the Israelites were taken off into exile. And as they went off into exile, they went past the place where Rachel was buried, and they would have remembered her sadness and remembered, related it to their own sadness. And now Matthew is updating it a bit more and placing all that in the context of another lot of sadness based upon more children dying and mother's grief and so on. Wow. So there's a lot going on there. Jeremiah is looking back to a previous event to do with Rachel and Ramah. But there's another point not to miss, although it's easy for us to miss it. If we know the whole of Jeremiah 31, which this quote is taken from, well, what eventually do we read in Jeremiah 31?
New Covenant.
The New Covenant comes in that chapter. And in fact, from verse 16 onwards, from the verse after the quotation has happened, it's a matter of hope. So actually, for those that would recognize that one verse and know the rest of the chapter, a message of hope starts to emerge that even though there is this sadness, God is going to bring something new and good out of it. And eventually, Jeremiah talks about a new covenant.
That's fine.
So there's a lot going on there, and I don't admit that it's, you know, not claiming it's particularly easy, but once you try and understand what Matthew is doing, you have to dig back into those same scriptures and see the point that he's making. He's trying to show that God had it all in hand, and the story of Jesus is actually planned and purposed. Nothing happened by accident. Yeah. Right, let's move to the other one at the end of chapter 2. And you must have noticed something about what Matthew says here in his own little formula citation, his own little introductory statement. What does he actually say?
Verse 23.
Yeah. So when Matthew is introducing the quotation, he now says something slightly different. So was fulfilled
by the prophets.
Prophets. Plural.
Oh, I haven't got plural.
And however hard you look, there shouldn't be a footnote, really, to this. Perhaps some Bibles do it a bit better. But there is absolutely no such prophecy in the Old Testament that he's quoting. So now he really seems to be playing games. Because he's saying, this something is being fulfilled here that was said through the prophets, but there's no prophet to look back on. So what does he mean? What's he doing here? Well, by using the plural, at least he's being honest that he's not saying there was a prophet that said this. He's saying that collectively, the prophets seem to suggest something that goes with this idea if he will be called a Nazarene. So now we've got to try and understand this particular quote. And I mentioned it last time, I think it'd be last time, when I said, remember how the early church were not called Christians, they were called the sect of the Nazarenes. And again, Jesus himself was never called a Nazarene, so eventually that was applied to his followers. So what's actually going on here? Now let's get one thing straight right from the beginning. People who lived or were brought up in Nazareth were not called Nazarenes. It is not the same as saying he went and lived, or he was born in London, so he was called a Cockney.
London.
Brought up in Birmingham, so he was a Brummie.
John was a Nazarene.
Or a Geordie, or anything like that. There is no geographical intention here at all. What there is a wordplay. And the wordplay is based upon the consonants of the two words, because obviously they are similar. You've got the N-Z-R of Nazareth, and the N-Z-R of Nazarene. And that's enough for Matthew to draw a link with what the Nazar really is, which is a branch. And now we get prophetic statements coming in where Jesus was referred to as a branch. And Isaiah 11:1 is the main one. You want to look it up. So in Isaiah, it doesn't say Jesus will be called a Nazarene, but it does say that he will be, what is it, a branch of David?
Jesse.
Jesse and David and so on. And there are probably one or two other places in the prophets where Jesus is regarded as being, shall we say, like a branch or something growing out of the stump of Jesse and David. So Matthew is here engaging in a bit of wordplay to link it back to what the prophets have said. And but I don't know for sure, but maybe Nazareth itself was named Nazareth because it had something to do with trees and branches. So maybe that's the way it was named. But not all places have a simple derivation like that. But this sort of wordplay, the best sort of thing I can think of, because it doesn't really work with Chesham where I live, but it's as though he went and lived in, say, Beaconsfield. And from that, the writer draws the implication that he will be a light to the surrounding area. He will be a beacon to the surrounding fields. Right? He's trying to use the word itself to say something about what Jesus would be like. Again, nothing specifically prophetic about it, but there is something going on in Matthew's understanding of things. So is someone saying something?
May I ask a question?
Yes.
Is there a connection with the Nazarite vow?
Can't see it. That is the other option that is mentioned, but Jesus never was a Nazarite. He never took that vow.
No.
But if you mean, was there a link verbally? In other words, because the word seems to share the same consonants. But I'm told that Nazarite, the Greek word that would be used, Nazireos or something, is close but different in its derivation. So although it shares the same three consonants, it isn't quite close enough to relate to it. But then again, as I say, he was not known as a Nazarite. He didn't take the Nazarite vows. I dare say if he had done, Matthew would have tried to make a link with Nazareth that way. But actually, he was more interested in his understanding that Jesus was the branch. And maybe, because he's writing long after all this had happened, he now knew that the early church were called the sect of the Nazarenes. So he's explaining that as part of it as well. We are little branches. We are joined to him. Okay. Shall we move on? Because we want to try and get through all 10 in our time. So the new one in Matthew 4, 14 to 16 seems to be based upon Isaiah 9, verses 1 to 2. And I think this one is fairly simple. At this point in Jesus' ministry, and by the way, I think it's interesting that this four of these quotations, very quickly in the first two chapters, all related to Jesus' birth and upbringing and the early part of his life, as though Matthew really wants to get us grounded in this idea of who Jesus is by digging into the scriptures early on, and then it can space out a bit more. But at this point in the Gospels, Jesus has left Nazareth, he's living in Capernaum, he's up in Galilee, he's in the area of Zebulun and Naphtali, and lo and behold, there's a very nice little quotation from Isaiah, which will help us to understand something. And that understanding is quite simple. In Isaiah's day, there was a promise of favour to an otherwise area of Israel that wasn't normally favoured or thought of as being high up in God's priority and his promises. But Isaiah said something, and maybe here there is a little bit more of a sort of predicted element. But again, I don't think in Isaiah 9 you've got any idea of a Messiah yet. The messianic predictions don't come in till much later in their history, and certainly in Isaiah's book. But God was promising something special for an area that was normally regarded as a bit of a sort of backwoods area. Backwood, I meant to say, not backwards. But, you know, the backward idea of being out in the sticks. Okay? And so Matthew is saying, isn't it wonderful that God placed Jesus in this area so that he could indeed be the light that Isaiah mentions in this particular context? And that's all I've got on that one, because I don't think there's any more to dig into it.
So why was a connection to the north, to northern Israel and Yeshua? Why was Matthew making this connection?
Because Jesus began his ministry up there. He went and lived in Capernaum.
Okay, yeah.
So he lived in the area around the Lake of Galilee, which was originally in the territory of Zebulun and Naphtali. And you might think, why isn't he moving down to Jerusalem? Or why isn't he, getting in with the big leaders and so on? Why is he going there? Which might seem as though God has made a mistake. No, God hasn't made a mistake, because this prophecy from Isaiah can be fulfilled in Jesus, as Jesus himself is going to be a light in their darkness. And also, he is explaining how once Jesus started teaching and healing, it was like a big light was switched on.
Can I just give you the comment in this Bible?
Please do, yes.
Chapter 9, verse 2, a great light. The gospel writers connected this verse with Jesus, whose ministry was geographically situated in the Galilee of nations. And it quotes Matthew 4, 15, 16 and Luke 2, 32.
Yeah. Yes. You might find some of these similar things in other gospels, but it's clear that Matthew is setting his stall out to create a whole group of statements like this in order to make his case. We'll see what that case is at the end of it all. The next one in 8:17 is Isaiah 53:4. You might find this one's a bit closer to the actual Hebrew than some of the others. But again, all he's doing really is helping us to understand Jesus' ministry. And this is the first time he brings a quote into Jesus' ministry, pointing out that the healings that he was doing and the driving out of the spirits was all expected, or should have been expected, to what Messiah was going to do. So in that sense, you could say there's a bit more of an actual fulfillment going on. I don't know whether there is a slight difference in the words, because Matthew says he took up our infirmities, he carried our diseases. When you look it up in Isaiah 53, does it say the same words?
Yeah.
Is that a yes or a no? Sorry.
He bore. Yeah. Bore and carried.
Bore and carried. Yeah. Okay.
Yeah.
What, of course, it is saying is that he took them up and carried them away. We need to understand it's not that he took them upon himself. He actually picked them up and carried them away, or threw them away, got rid of them. In other words, when he healed people, it wasn't because he became sick himself. I don't suppose we ever would have thought that, but the words have to be understood a bit more carefully and so on. So Matthew continues to build up his picture of what's happening. And if we move to the next one in chapter 12, you get a very long one. This is the longest of all his quotations. Again, he uses Isaiah. He uses Isaiah a lot. This actually is from what's called the Servant Song, one of the Servant Songs. And again, there's a fairly simple sort of summary going on here of what Jesus' ministry was like. And if at this point people were thinking, this isn't the Messiah that I expected, Jesus isn't being tough enough, he's not being aggressive enough, why isn't he dealing with the Romans and all the rest of it? The message here is that Jesus is doing exactly what God intended, because he did speak through Isaiah and others about what he will do. And he speaks a lovely section, I think, from Isaiah. It's quite a well-known verse there in verse 20 in Matthew, about the bruised reed he will not break, and the smouldering wick he will not snuff out. These are very common things in their actual ordinary lives. They used reeds and wicks a huge amount, as you can probably imagine. But any reed that was not perfect, that was in any way bruised or bent or something, would be just thrown away. And any wick that was dying and smouldering would be just snuffed out and thrown away. But Jesus isn't there to do that. He's there to heal people, rescue them, pick them up, and so on. And there's a lovely bit, in his name the nations will put their hope. And that means in the end, he's showing us that Jesus is the one that we can trust. We can put our hope in him. So we've done 7 now. We're getting there. The next one. Now, before I put it up, I want you to look at it yourself. This is chapter 13 and verse 35. Chapter 13 and verse 35. So was fulfilled what was spoken through the prophet. And away we go. Does your footnote give you a reference to a prophet?
Psalm.
Oh dear, Matthew does seem to be messing us about. He's claiming it comes from a prophet, but it's actually from a psalm. Well, can a psalm be prophetic?
Why not?
Why not? Particularly
if it was a David one?
Ah, well, it isn't. Have a look.
Oh, it's Asaph.
It's Asaph. What do you know about Asaph?
Well, he was one of the leaders of the music and declarations in the worship.
He was the main worship leader that David appointed. But he's described also as something else. Well, actually, it's described as a prophet, but it's an old-fashioned word for it.
A seer?
Asaph was a seer, yes. So he had prophetic gifts as well as worship gifts or whatever. So whenever you're reading a psalm by Asaph, and I think there's about 12 or maybe 13 psalms of Asaph, think of them as being written by someone who had something extra about him, if you like. But again, what Matthew does is he plucks this verse out of the middle of a psalm, takes it completely out of context.
Ooh.
Naughty man, not allowed to do that. And he's done it purely on a word association of parable. Because Jesus is now speaking in parables, and so he takes us back into a psalm where the guy mentions, well, parables. In fact, the word that in Hebrew would be used for parable isn't quite the same as the sort of parables we understand Jesus doing. There are any enigmatic sayings, difficult sayings, hidden sayings, ones that required a bit of extra insight and explanation. But if you read the whole psalm sometime, that psalm is simply repeating Israel's history. It's a repetition of what Israel went through as a people. And that, again, is the point that Matthew is trying to make. He wants to link Jesus to Israel, to his people. Again, I'll spell that out a bit more at the end. So at this point, when Jesus starts speaking in parables, he picks out a verse that says, I will open my mouth in parables and utter things hidden since the creation of the world, to remind everybody, not just of that verse, but of the whole psalm, and to make them think about Israel's history and to think about Jesus within that context.
Sorry, Paul, I was daydreaming. Can you just repeat yourself?
Yes. Asaph's psalm is effectively a repeat of Israel's history. But I don't just mean it's necessarily only that, but Asaph takes us through Israel's history in order to make his prophetic points. So Matthew, now that Jesus is speaking in parables, picks a verse from that psalm that's got the word parables in it, purely as a word association thing, in order for then people, when they read that verse, they think of the whole psalm, and they think of what Israel went through, all the stuff that Asaph wrote about it, and link it in with Jesus. So he's setting up a correspondence between Jesus, who spoke in parables, and Israel, who is mentioned in this psalm in the context of parables or saying.
Thank you.
Is that okay?
Yeah.
Again, it's up to you, but it'd be a good idea to go back through all of these things again, all these quotations that Matthew is using, and really go back and look at the Old Testament context a bit more to try and, well, basically get out of it what Matthew wants us to get out of it. And again, I'll say a bit more in a moment. Right, the one in chapter 21, verses 4 and 5. Quite a well-known one again. Have I got this right? Yes, 21, 4 and 5. Triumphal entry. All this took place to fulfill what was spoken through the prophet. Now, have you got anything to help you know which prophet that is? Your footnote will almost certainly say Zechariah chapter 9, verse 9.
Yeah.
But actually, it's also Isaiah 62, verse 11. Now, if you'd sort of handle all these three texts at the same time is a bit tricky. And again, you might want to check this out later in your own time. The actual opening, say to the daughter of Zion, doesn't come from Zechariah. It comes from Isaiah 62. And it is a verbatim quote from the Septuagint. He's actually taken that Greek opening of that verse And the rest of this quotation is a free version of Zechariah 9:9. He's actually abbreviated it. He's taken some bits out of it and he's linked it to Isaiah 62. Again, you might think, are you allowed to do all that? Well, actually, you could. Something I said a long time back is that you're never, ever allowed to play around with the Torah, the first five books. Once you get into the prophets, then you can start to do this Midrash more. And the other books after that are even more sort of open to being interpreted.
No.
But the point is, what is Matthew's emphasis? What is he actually wanting to say at this point about Jesus? And it's there in the Zechariah passage, and it's meekness. But Zechariah says lots of other things. And Matthew doesn't want to get us overburdened and complicated. He's simply trying to help us understand the fact that Jesus is going to come in riding on a donkey. And that is an emphasis of meekness. So Matthew has found that in Zechariah, but it's sort of cloudy with a few other things. So he's fiddled around with it a little bit and attached it to Isaiah 62 because it seems to introduce it better and so on. And then there's another problem with this one. How many animals are there in this situation? How many animals are there in the quotation from Zechariah?
And a colt, the foal of a donkey, is it?
Yes, so how many altogether?
Two, mum and donkey, yeah. Let.
Okay, well, there's certainly two. Okay, so Zechariah has, in his quotation, got two. And therefore, Jesus has to have two. They brought the donkey and the colt. If you read it in the other Gospels, there's only one. There's only one mentioned. The other Gospel writers don't bother with this quote. And it's as though Matthew, having decided that he wants to bring this verse in from Zechariah, has suddenly ended up with one animal too many. And the sort of accusation could be levelled, as he therefore got it wrong, as he made one of the animals up, and so on. Now, of course, it's more the other way round, that the other Gospel writers only mention one of the two. And there could well have been two, but of course Jesus can only actually ride on one at the same time, at one at a time.
But the way that it's written doesn't really imply that in, like, some of the Bibles.
Which bit are you talking about, sorry?
Well, Matthew says, upon a colt, a son of a donkey.
Yes, but beforehand, it's gentleman riding on a donkey, and then on a colt, the foal of a donkey.
But then Zechariah says, lowly and riding on a donkey, even on a colt, the foal of a donkey. But
you put an even in there, have you?
Yeah, is it describing the same donkey that it's a foal of a donkey?
Well, it is if you translate it like that. Is that the correct way to translate Zechariah? Or has, I don't quite know which version you're using.
The one new man.
Okay. Is it a case of, because there was really only one donkey that we know of, we've got to change what Zechariah said? Because if Matthew's going to use it, it's got to be accurate and so on. So presumably Zechariah only had one in mind anyway.
How do you get round Matthew 21, verse 7, then?
Well, I don't get round it because I'm assuming that Zechariah mentions two. And because Matthew is saying that this is being fulfilled, they did actually bring two animals. Now, I think you just said a moment ago, did you use the word mother?
Yeah.
Okay. So the colt and the donkey were related, yes?
I would think.
Yes. And remember the one thing about the colt that we certainly learned from elsewhere is that he had not yet been ridden on by anyone.
Yeah.
Right? That's a very difficult thing to do, or to be the first person to try and do. And just think where this donkey is going to go, or the colt is going to go. When Jesus starts riding, they're going to go into the big city with lots of crowds, lots of people shouting, waving their clothes around and palm branches. And any young colt that's certainly not been ridden on before would be scared. The idea, therefore, is basically, as I put here, and mother came too. They didn't want to separate the colt from its mother at this point in order to sort of give reassurance. So that's how I explain it. I explain it as two related donkeys. And then if you're asking me to explain, place their cloaks on them, that's fine. And Jesus sat on them. What on earth did Jesus sit on? Did he sit on two animals at the same time in some kind of great sort of straddling enterprise? The second them actually refers to the cloaks. So they put lots of cloaks on both animals, and Jesus sat on the cloaks, and therefore he was only sitting on one of them, the colt, which therefore now agrees with the other Gospels.
I've got in the CJB, it translates the Zechariah prophecy as, yes, he is humble, he's riding on a donkey, yes, on a lowly donkey's colt, which is very typical Old Testament language, where it says something and then it develops it. It's like yeah, poetic language.
True. In other words, again, you're reducing Zechariah to just one animal.
Not necessarily.
Well, it
doesn't exclude the fact that the mother might have been there.
Well, we've still got the problem with verse 7, that it talks about the donkey and the colt. Matthew clearly is saying there's two animals. Do you see the point I'm getting at?
Yeah.
Unless Matthew has made a mistake, either because he didn't understand Zechariah, or because he's at odds with the other gospel writers, somehow we've got to understand the two. And I would understand the two from the fact that that's what Zechariah actually meant. Although I understand these other translations seem to want to say it could only have been one. Okay. But it looks like there were two animals involved in this particular scene, which in most pictures or films or whatever, you tend not to see. I think you only tend to see one. But then he could only ride one at a time, don't they know?
Oh, what was
the Isaiah quote again? Sorry, Ash. 62:11. Isaiah 62:11. Only the first bit. Because in Jeremiah, I don't think you have say to the daughter of Zion. I must admit, I'm not fiddling around from text to text here because I've got my other PowerPoints and other notes to refer to. So I'm not doing what you're doing, hopefully, and looking every verse up. But and tell me if I'm wrong, but I think in Zechariah 9:9, it doesn't start, say to the daughter of Zion. But in Isaiah 62:11, it does.
Yeah, a note in our Bible says that typically a mother donkey followed her offspring closely and would have been difficult to separate from it.
Yes, I mean, yeah, actually, that's probably slightly better than an explanation that I was given, that I was saying about how the colt would struggle on its own. But actually, they might have been very difficult to separate at the beginning anyway. You know, the mother would have kicked up a fuss.
Yeah.
So they had to bring
it. If he's riding the colt, the colt would be very young and not able to take a human's weight.
If
the colt is young enough to follow the mother, then he would have been riding the mother.
Yeah.
But they all say he rode the colt.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So to me, having the mother there is illogical, unless they kept the colt at several years old near the mother.
Yeah.
Donkeys are phenomenal beasts of burden. They've got a great strength. So a colt probably could carry a person. I'm not a donkey raiser, but...
But you're certainly right that the donkey is the main animal in the Old Testament. Donkeys were very highly regarded. It was part of your herd, your riches and so on. And of course, there's no mention of horses until Solomon gets horses, and he got them from outside of Israel.
Yeah.
So the donkey was the main animal in Israel for riding on and for carrying things. So, yeah. But of course, the point again is most victorious people come riding in on a horse, and Jesus chose a donkey, and particularly one that had never been ridden before.
Can I give you the comments from this Bible?
Yeah.
It's to do with the symbolism. So Zechariah 9:9, riding on a donkey, the image of a king of peace who is not riding on a war horse, which is referred to a couple of verses later, directly relates to Jesus' triumphal entry, Matthew 21. And then Matthew 21, by simply riding the donkey, Jesus was making a messianic claim. The entire crowd understood immediately what was happening.
Yeah. Yeah. Thank you. The last one then, which is another complicated one. Matthew 27:9-10. And Matthew now actually says what was spoken by Jeremiah the prophet. Great. We know what we're looking for. Does your footnote bear that out? Did it tell you whereabouts in Jeremiah?
32:6-9.
Yeah.
Just that?
No, it's got Zechariah 11.
Ah, oh, there's some Zechariah as well, is there?
Yeah.
Zechariah 11.
Yeah.
And maybe even some Jeremiah 19. As well as Jeremiah 32. Yep. So I've got Zechariah 11:12-13. Mm-hmm. Jeremiah 19:1-13. And 32:6-9. We've got a right hotchpotch here. There's no direct quote at all. It's lots of bits from Jeremiah plus a bit from Zechariah. And in fact, the primary source is Zechariah, in the sense that without that, the whole thing makes no sense at all. Not just tacked on. Zechariah 11:12-13 has the prophet throwing 30 pieces of silver into the house of the Lord to the potter. And that's the key sort of parallel. But there's no mention in Zechariah of a field being bought. So in order to bring that bit into it, Matthew turns to Jeremiah 32:6-9, where Jeremiah purchased a field from his cousin, but not with 30 pieces of silver, but with 17. But when he buys that field, there's no mention of a potter. So Matthew has a further search around for some passages that's got a potter in it. And by the time he's linked all these three bits together, he's got everything he wants. The 30 pieces of silver, the field being bought, and a potter. Wow.
What's the reference of the potter?
That being Jeremiah 19:1-13. You actually get a little bit in Jeremiah 18 as well. But Jeremiah 19 is the main bit about a potter. But it's a very minor bit. That's all it contributes. So the point I'm heading towards in this is that he's had to dig around in lots of prophets. The primary source is Zechariah, but he's backed it up with a bit of Jeremiah to get the full picture. And then he goes and says that then what was spoken by Jeremiah the prophet, well, most of it wasn't spoken by Jeremiah, it was spoken by Zechariah. Oh dear, what's happening there? Well, fairly explicable, easy to explain. Whenever you quoted from two prophets together in this sort of conflation, this sort of joining up together, you always attributed it to the most senior, the more senior of the two. And Jeremiah was regarded as a more prominent or better known prophet than Zechariah. So in the end, he gets the credit, if you like. But don't worry, because if you'd learned all your scriptures and off by heart and so on, you'd know full well that Zechariah, you know, is in there. He just doesn't get a mention. And just to back that particular thought up, while you're still getting your head around all that, one other place this happens, I'll give you a minute to look this up as well. Look at the opening of Mark's Gospel. Mark chapter 1 and verse 2. In Mark chapter 1 and verse 2, we're going to have this famous, "I will send my messenger ahead of you." And if you've got a footnote reference, does it refer you to anything in Isaiah?
Only verse 3.
Of chapter 40. Chapter 40, verse 3.
Well,
part of the quote is from elsewhere.
Verse 3 of Mark refers to 43.
Indeed.
I've got Malachi 3:1 as well.
Exactly, because it's in verse 2 that Mark says it is written in Isaiah the prophet. And the first bit, and there was the rest of chapter 2, sorry, the rest of verse 2, "I will send my messenger ahead of you who will prepare your way," isn't from Isaiah at all. It is from Malachi chapter 3, verse 1. So why is he said it's written in Isaiah? For the same reason, there's two prophets mentioned. Isaiah clearly is the main guy, Malachi less so. It gets attributed to Isaiah. You don't say it was written in Malachi and Isaiah, or this bit was written in Malachi, this bit, and so on. So it's common practice to mention only one. So I'm going to let I'm going to let Matthew off by not mentioning Zechariah in the last one. Right. Well, as you said, someone said for the first one, that sort of blown everything apart that you might have thought.
Yes.
Done it with a few others. But let's understand why this is going on. And then again, if you want to study these in a bit more detail, try and dig back into the Old Testament a little bit. It all comes down to what Matthew means when he says fulfillment. There are different ways of thinking of the word fulfillment. One is a prediction has come true, the verification of a prediction. Someone said, this is going to happen down the road. It happens. Tick it off. It's been fulfilled. Another way of talking about fulfillment is that an undertaking or obligation has actually been completed. You said you're going to do something and you discharged your duty on it. You have fulfilled what was given to you to do. But the other way, which is the way that it works in Scripture, is that fulfillment is the consummation of promise. It's not about predictions being verified. It's about promises coming to a consummation. And those promises are largely covenant promises. What Matthew has seen in Jesus is that not that a lot of proof texts which were planted into the Old Testament, waiting for someone to come along, have somehow suddenly been launched and landed and arrived in this person called Jesus. But rather, in the life and ministry of Jesus, Matthew saw the perfecting and realization of the entire goal of God's plan for Israel. This is the climax of all God's previous activity and relationships and promises and covenants.
that's really close, isn't it, to Day of Pentecost and Peter saying about Joel, this that you are seeing today is that, and now it's happened, this must definitely be that. I can see it now because now is when it's evidenced. Up until yesterday, we didn't see it, but now we see it.
Exactly. And there's a bigger case for looking backwards than looking forwards. In other words, whether you want to think that Joel was predicting something that was one day going to happen, but it probably happened in his day anyway, because unless the very sort of rare prophecies, which can only be fulfilled at the very end of time, for instance, most of what the prophet said, remember what prophecy is, it's not foretelling, this is not Mystic Meg or some other kind of horoscope sort of thing, they are forthtelling the word of God. They're bringing the word of God into people's lives there and then. And people would expect that what the prophet said would have some kind of fulfillment in their own lives, in their own situations. But what was true then for Isaiah or Joel or whatever has become more so now that Jesus has arrived. There is what, and this is a technical term, a fuller sense. The technical term actually is in Latin, but I won't bother you with that. But we can talk about these texts now that Matthew has plundered, for want of a better word, someone said mind when he looked back in them. He's found a fuller sense or a deeper meaning. He's discovered within the existing scripture something that may not have been apparent to the original author. But now that Jesus has come, it has now been fulfilled in a new way. There is a new depth of meaning and level of significance that Matthew draws out, not inconsistent with the original purpose of the passage, not denying what was intended then, but he has seen that God has brought a promise to fulfillment in Jesus. There is like a fresh revelation that could not have happened without Jesus. He's not violating the previous text and what was said then. He's setting them now within the wider context of what God has been doing and was always planning to do. He's bringing out a new correspondence between the old covenants and the new. He's actually drawing them together, threading them together, if you like, not through a series of fanciful parallels or hidden metaphors, but by new events in the life of Jesus that link back to real events and real words from before. If you like, he's now showing this is what it's really all about. You sort of half got it before, but now you can see it bigger and better. And in particular, he wants to see Jesus, wants us to see Jesus as the new Israel, the representative of God's people, who is now going to sum up and bring to completion everything that God intended so that now it can be spread to all nations and the whole world, because that was the point of the new covenant. So I said Matthew is doing something called Midrash, a Jewish teaching method, drawing more out of the text, and all the other writers did it. And in his case, he is creating what's sometimes called a typology, but don't worry about that word if you like. Just think of it as a link. But if you know your theology, then you've heard of typologies. Not just between Jesus and Moses, not just between Jesus and David as individual bits, but a bigger typology between Jesus and Israel. And it's sometimes called a recapitulation, which means that Jesus came along to first and foremost repeat or recapitulate Israel's history, but Jesus did it successfully and completed it in the way that God intended. and Matthew wants to produce as close an association as possible between God's old people and Jesus, who is now going to be Messiah, not just of Israel, but of the whole world. But he needs to link Jesus back in, and that's what he does. The whole pattern of Israel's story has been gathered up and reproduced in Jesus, and in that sense it is now being filled up to the full, or fulfilled, by the birth, ministry, death, resurrection of someone. Jesus encapsulates it all. Jesus has gathered up both ends of Israel's story and brought it to its God-appointed completion. Now, for this to be successful, you've got to be familiar with the Old Testament as a whole. And that's why Matthew is regarded as writing mainly for Jewish believers, because they would need to understand these texts and at least be able to look back and make something of them. He's relying upon a shared tradition between himself and his readership. It doesn't work if you're quoting from texts that people don't really fully understand. So he is relying upon the common background and shared traditions that they have. But it's a very clever sort of device for telling a story in which you've got a bigger picture and you want to draw others into it. So that while his readers were reading the text or hearing it read out or whatever, it drew them more into what Matthew was trying to say. And in some ways, it provides a new depth to what otherwise you would just read. If you take those formula quotations out of the text, you'll still get the Jesus story. You'll still understand what Jesus did. But this provides, if you like, bonus material, bonus meanings for those that are well enough instructed in the Old Testament knowledge and God's previous plans, that they can see beyond just the Jesus story into the whole thing that God has been doing. Has that made sense?
Yep.
The last bit I've been doing, I've been basically reading out what I've written, but it was easier to read out something I'd prepared early, if you like. Good.
Do we know how much Matthew was the gospel that made sense to the early church because they all knew the Hebrew scriptures so well? Do we have any indication of...
To the Jewish part, you know?
Yeah.
Well, I think so. I don't know a lot of details myself, but we do think that Matthew's gospel is certainly the most Hebraic in many ways. And one of the things, I'll let on to a secret here. I studied these texts a long time ago and wrote a whole dissertation on them. And as well as going through the different texts, what I had to do was bring out the implications for Matthew's theology and who Matthew therefore really was as an author and who his readers were. And you're bound to come to the conclusion, which is, I think, a sound one theologically, that Matthew did have Jewish believers in mind when he compiled his gospel.
Yeah.
Whereas Mark didn't and Luke didn't and John was late as well.
I've heard that and read about it as well. I've actually got...
Who's the author of that? Because I can't read that.
It's a commentary by Carol Robertson.
Okay, not heard of him, but...
But it's Matthew, the Hebrew Gospel, and there's three volumes.
Okay, thank you. I'll try and remember that, yeah, okay. It's a commentary on the Gospel of Matthew, but by explaining it as a Hebrew book.
Yeah.
Good. Save me writing it then.
Well, no, he definitely didn't do it as in-depth as you, that's for sure, Paul.
Oh, but he's done the whole Gospel, which is different. But presumably, does he do it sort of chapter by chapter?
Yeah, he does. Uh-huh. And I've not read the whole thing, but I've dipped in and out for different...
Yeah, aspects. Well, now you can dip in and out on the bits of these... particular quotations and see if he puts them within this bigger picture.
Yeah,
yeah, great. Okay, any other final comments? We're about to finish in a minute. I'm just going to say what we'd like to do next time, but any other comments on all this?
Thank you.
Yeah.
Okay.
Can I just go back to the donkey?
Yes, okay.
I can't find what age a colt would leave its mother, but a grown donkey is, its joints aren't strong enough until it's at least 3 years old.
Okay.
Which is a lot longer than, weaning is about 6 months.
Okay. Useful donkey knowledge there. Thank you very much.
By Google, I think.
Definitely.
Yes. Can I stop the video? I mean, the audio.
Yes. Well, let me just say what I'm going to do next time. I think it's, I mean, we do a lot more on what midrashes and so on, and I might come back to it before we finish our series. But I don't want to delay any longer looking at some of the end time prophecies now. Again, a big topic, so it's not going to be, you know, it could take forever if we, well, not forever because the Lord's coming back, but you know what I mean. So if the Lord doesn't come back within a week, we'll start to look at what that's like. I want to leave you with a question and a passage to look at. Question is, why should Jesus come back at all? The most important question is why. Not the what, the how, the when, the where, and all the rest of it. But if you understand the why, that's the main thing. Why should Jesus actually come back? I mean, he's okay where he is, isn't he?
Yes, but we're not.
But we can die and go to heaven, can't we? So anyway, just try and think it through in terms of why. And the other thing is a passage perhaps to look at is 2 Thessalonians chapter 2, where I would simply read it through with you and just try and explain in simple terms what Paul says. Because my main point in looking at the end time stuff, again, remember what we're trying to do, open the ancient wells. This is the area that's been more muddied through traditions, theologies, and all the rest of it. And how on earth do we get back down through all that to what at the time should have been sometimes mysterious, but not as complicated as we have made it. Okay, and I really can't do it all in one evening anyway, but at least I can start to show you a little bit about how man has taken a very important aspect of God's word and almost created so much confusion that nobody wants to really go into it anymore, or it's been left to the fanatics. And that's a real shame. And from there, it might lead on into thinking more generally about theologies and the role that they've played in looking at the Bible and so on. So that's what we're going to do next time. So anything else before I sign off?
Yeah, which Thess, 1 or 2?
2 Thessalonians chapter 2.
Got it.
It's not necessarily the whole chapter, but... what I want as a good exercise is just pretend you're in Thessalonica, this letter arrives, and Paul says this to you. Forget everything you've heard before, all the stuff you've had your mind clouded up with. Just try and read it as though Paul is writing it to you for the first time in AD, whatever it was, 50 or something. And I'll go through it and help with the words. At some point, so might start with that, or I might do that at the end of the session. I'll make sure there's enough time to cover that. Any final thoughts or comments or questions or
Paul?
Yeah,
it's Monica here.
Oh, hello again.
Hiya. I might not articulate this very well, but from what you've said this evening, are there implications to how we should read out the book of Revelation? Does that make...
Well,
you know what I mean?
Because I do.
What you've said about the Old Testament prophecies.
Okay.
And how they were written down, and that Matthew looked back and recognised and used them and pulled them together.
Yes.
So are we wrong to look at the book of Revelation and try and work things out, but we need to wait until things actually happen and then recognise them?
That's a very good question, and I would sort of agree with it. I've got three parts to the answer, I think. Firstly, the book of Revelation has more references to the Old Testament than any other part of the scripture. Even if it's not directly quoted, you cannot understand it. And someone said it's 400 or 500, which, I mean, I can't find that amount. But there's always, always drawing upon things that are there in the past. That's the first thing. The second thing is, when I've taught end time stuff as a sort of series, of a course, I've said, never, ever start with the book of Revelation. Okay? Mm. It will throw you completely. You have got to go through a process, because don't forget, Revelation was the last thing that God revealed, and he didn't reveal it until about AD 90, and he only revealed it through John. Okay? So I'll explain a bit more about that, but what I'm saying is, it's not the book you can first delve into and sort it all out. Mm. And the second, the third thing I think it is, and I hope this is answering your question as I'm saying all this, you've got to imagine again that that book has arrived at your church at that time and is read out to you, and it wasn't there to be presented as a series of in-depth Bible studies that you've got to spend the next 5 years working out what it means. Mm-hmm. It had to make an immediate impact, and it would have done. And again, part of what you're saying is, have we made it too complicated? Have we tried to make it say lots of things that were never intended? The chances are yes, but I'm not going to rule out the fact that it will come into sharper focus the closer we get to things actually happening. So the answer to your question is yes, there is a good point there, that you do sometimes, someone said, you live life forwards but understand it backwards. And it's not until things have happened that you actually do start to understand better what's happened. And, you know, even at the time of Jesus, they didn't understand him properly until the very end, or after he'd left them. You know, they didn't get it all at once. And wait till next time and ask more questions on this, but there is a reason why the end time stuff is meant to have a complexity about it and a mystery about it. The trouble is, because we haven't accepted it like that, we've tried to clarify it, and in clarifying it, we've made it more complicated, because human thinking has come into play here. Mm. We need more revelation from God, and that will come at the right time, in the right way, not through lots of clever people studying it for ages and ages. And I'm not against people studying it, but that in itself does not unlock it. What unlocks it is looking at what God is actually doing in the world today and relating the book to that, if you like. So anyway, yeah, thank you for saying that. Remind me again another time, if you like. But...
yeah, thanks.
Okay then.
Thank you, Paul.
Thank you very much.
Thanks, Paul.
Thanks very much then.
Okay, bye to people.